Gwendolyn Brooks was one of America's greatest poets, and a new play celebrates her life's work in a unique way.
They didn't go too far in school in terms of telling us who she was and what her impact was or anything like that. So when I started doing the research, I said, this woman was amazing.
We talked to members of Manual Cinema about their play, No Blue Memories, The Life of Gwendolyn Brooks. Also, how can art be used in the fight against AIDS? But first, who's in charge of telling you when your tap water isn't safe to drink? Last week, some Champaign residents like James Manricki weren't getting a straight answer.
The representative on the phone wasn't able to tell me if my address was covered. To me, that was just really weird that Illinois American Water or whatever has the info somewhere in their system as to who it affects, but that the rep wasn't able to tell me.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, how one Chicago cinema troupe is using puppets, music, and overhead projectors to tell the story of poet Gwendolyn Brooks tonight. Brooks' life. They've got a performance tonight in Urbana. Also, as World AIDS Day approaches, we learn about a new film that gets its Illinois premiere this weekend. But first, clean tap water is supposed to be a given. It's regulated, it's safe to drink, and when it's not, the water company or the health department is supposed to tell you, right? Well, it turns out it's not that simple. Just last week, some Champaign County residents weren't getting the right information, including me. I turned on my tap and saw discolored water coming out, even though I wasn't notified of a boil order. After a call to the water company, they said I was under a boil water order, and other people were confused by this. Others called the water company to ask if water in their home was safe. Representatives weren't able to tell them. Here's Champaign Urbana resident James Manricki, who spoke with WILL last week.
The representative on the phone wasn't able to tell me if my address was covered. To me, that was just really weird that Illinois American Water or whatever has the info somewhere in their system as to who it affects, but that the rep wasn't able to tell me.
Champaign, of course, isn't the only community where there's been confusion over boil orders and water quality. Advocates have long been concerned about the process for notifying the public. One National Resources Defense Council report released last year found that Americans have a nearly 1 in 4 chance of having tap water that's either unsafe to drink or not being properly monitored. Walt Kelly is head of the Illinois State Water Survey Center for Groundwater Science. He's with us from his Champaign office to help us understand a little bit more about this. May Wu is also on the line from Washington, where she's a senior attorney with the NRDC's health program. Walt, May, good morning. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May, I wonder if we could just first of all start with this whole idea of a boil water order. What does it mean when you're under a boil water order?
Generally, it probably happens if something has happened in, say, your drinking water system. Maybe they've lost pressure for some reason, or there's been a water main break, and they're worried that bacteria may have gotten into the drinking water, so they want you to boil it to kind of kill off the bacteria. And so that's oftentimes where you'll see a boil water notice.
And how common is that across the country, May?
The water main breaks are happening all the time. We have deteriorating infrastructure, and so we have pipes that are leaking. We have water mains that are breaking every day, and so there's constantly somebody who's probably under a boil water alert.
So I wonder if I can share a little bit more about my experience, because I wonder if this can help shed light on how confusing this can be. So when I had the really murky water, I had this back and forth all day with Illinois American Water. And after calling the company, they said that I was under this boil water order. And then later, when my station, WILL, started looking into this and called the spokespeople, they said that that wasn't the case, that I was never under a boil water order. Something else was wrong. And then other people started talking about this on social media, saying similar things had happened to them. May, at one point, Illinois American Water representatives told someone that anyone in a 5 to 10 mile radius of one existing boil water order should boil their water, which is like the whole city of Champaign. May, how common is this?
I have my own personal story here in D.C. Just this summer. I was also under a boil water alert, and I didn't know until my friend texted me to ask me what her pregnant friend should do because she got this boil water alert. And so it is a big problem, and you know, there are rules, national rules, around when public notification ought to happen and how it should happen, and those rules are violated a lot around the country. It's hard to say, you know, specifically where and like the exact situation that y'all had, but it is a problem that's happening across the country.
And you mentioned May, a pregnant friend. So for people who have a compromised immune systems, women who are pregnant, young children, those are people who especially need to be careful about?
Yeah, those are exactly the most vulnerable populations when we're talking about bacterial contamination. Young kids, pregnant women, elderly, immunocompromised, those are the ones that you really want to make sure have the most up-to-date information about when they should boil their water.
That's May Wu. She's on the line with us from Washington, where she is a senior attorney with NRDC's health program. Walt Kelly is with us from his Champaign office, where he's head of the Illinois State Water Survey Center for Groundwater Science. Walt, I mean, I think we've seen when we talk about water, people think about places like Flint, Michigan, that are very serious, that are a completely different level on the scale of water quality as opposed to just this boil water order. In general, Walt, do we know, first of all, how safe our water is in Illinois and who's responsible for regulating that?
Well, in general, if you're getting water from public water system, the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency is the regulatory body that covers that. And there's about 100 standards that water has to meet. So in general, we can be pretty confident that the water coming out of our taps is safe. Of course, you know, as May was talking about these boil waters, these infrastructure main breaks happen now and then the water needs to be, you know, taken care of. But if you're on a private well, and many citizens in Illinois who live out in the country, they're on private wells, and they're pretty much responsible themselves for their water quality. When a well is drilled, there's a one-time test where you test for coliform bacteria and nitrate, and if that passes, the health department says you're good to go, and from then on, you're on your own as far as your water quality is concerned.
If you've got a private well, Walt, how often should you be testing that?
Well, you should definitely test it when you first move in to a situation or move into your home. And we kind of recommend about every 5 years is probably a good rule of thumb. It also depends on kind of what land use practices might be going on around you. If you're in a heavily industrial or agricultural area, you might want to do it a little more often if you're worried about certain contaminants. Also, if you have a very shallow well, you might want to do it more often, maybe every year or every other year.
And while when it comes to our public water, if folks don't have a private well, we were actually talking about this yesterday with the state climatologist Jim Angel. He was talking about Lake Michigan, and we were talking about the quality of Lake Michigan. And he was mentioning, of course, that that's for Chicago. It's a huge source of drinking water is Lake Michigan for the city of Chicago. What about the rest of Illinois? Where are our water sources coming from outside of Chicago, Walt?
So once you get outside the main city in the near-in suburbs, most people are on either groundwater or reservoir systems. So down here, Champaign-Urbana, Normal, some other towns in the region are on the Mahomet Aquifer. That serves about 800,000 people in east central Illinois. But several cities in the region, Springfield, Decatur, Bloomington, and Danville, have surface water reservoirs where they get their water from. The further north you go, the better the groundwater resources are. So many people up north are on groundwater. There's a few cities that are on river water. For example, Aurora and Elgin are on the Fox River. Peoria gets some of their water from the Illinois River.
And Walt, is it your job then to test that groundwater? Is that what you all do?
Well, so we're a scientific research organization. We have no regulatory power. So what we do is basically try to understand what the resources are, what might be situations that are vulnerable to contamination, and what might be causing the contamination to occur. So it's we don't have any ability to shut down a well or anything like that.
But do you, I imagine you have an ability to contact EPA or let folks know if it's a private well, if there are problems? Is that how it works?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So we actually have a lab here. Anybody who has a well in the state of Illinois can contact our lab and have their water quality tested, we'll send out a kit. It's very, it used to be free, but then now it costs about $35, so it's still pretty cheap. And then they'll send that in to us, and then we send them back a report on what's in their water. This is just a mineral analysis. This doesn't include things like pesticides or other organic contaminants.
That's Walt Kelly, and we will tweet out, and we'll have that link at our website, 21stshow.org, for folks who are listening who have private wells and want information about how to test that. May, if coming back to the general, I wanted to ask you about the report that the NRDC released last year. I know this was based on 2015 data, but just about the fact that 1 in 4 Americans have a chance of their tap water being either unsafe to drink or not being properly monitored for the for contaminants. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem, like I said, that we are seeing across the country where, you know, we looked at violations of the drinking water rules, the EPA's federal drinking water rules, and found that there were these high rates of violations that were happening across the country. Actually, I just looked at the most recent data that came out of EPA, and it hasn't really changed much at all. What we're seeing is most of these violations are happening with, like, bacteria, again, lead, which is, you know, obviously our lawsuits in Flint and Newark are, you know, kind of bringing to light all the problems that we're having with lead in drinking water. But there are a lot of violations also in the public notice rules. But, you know, even looking past all these violations, there are problems with contaminants in drinking water that might not show up as a violation because of the, you know, the nuances with how the rule works. So, for example, we did a report maybe 8 or 10 years ago on atrazine, a pesticide that's used a lot in the Midwest. And there were high levels of atrazine being found in people's tap water coming out of the tap, but it wasn't showing up as a violation because EPA says you can average the number over the year. And so even though they were seeing spikes that were at levels that exceeded where we think the health risks might occur, they weren't getting any notification and the system wasn't shown as having any violations. So, you know, it goes beyond the violations, especially because we have a lot of contaminants that aren't being regulated at all. So there are a whole category of, say, the Teflon-like chemicals that are starting to show up in people's waters in Michigan and in North Carolina. EPA doesn't regulate them. So that's definitely not going to show up as a violation, but there are a lot of health risks associated with them that we're very concerned about.
Did you say Teflon, May?
Yes, that's right. Teflon-like chemicals. It's a whole family of chemicals. They're called perfluorinated chemicals. There's thousands of them in this group, but a couple of them were used to make Teflon materials, so the things that make your carpet stain resistant or to make your clothes stain resistant or, you know, to make your nonstick cookware. Those chemicals are showing up in a lot of people's water around the country, too.
So when it comes back to all of these, I'm curious just to ask both of you, and May, I wonder if I could start with you. We did reach out, by the way, to Illinois EPA. They declined to join our conversation today, as did Illinois American Water. Illinois American Water did send us a statement saying that they, last week when I was having my issues, they were having technical problems at their customer service center, they said, and they said they were not able to look at people. They were having a problem with their computer system, so they weren't able to view account information. So out of an abundance of caution, they were telling people to boil water. But I just want to ask you, May, when we reached out to the CU Public Health Department, they directed us to the EPA. The state EPA, as I mentioned, didn't respond to us. I don't understand who is in charge when our water isn't safe to drink. Is it the water company's responsibility to tell people? Is it the EPA's responsibility? Is it the public health department? Is it different depending on where you are, May?
I mean, the first responsibility really goes to the water system. So the utility, if it's a company or if it's, you know, a municipally run system, they're the ones who are under the obligation to notify their customers about the quality of the water. If they are failing in doing that, then the state, I guess the state EPA in Illinois, would be who needs to step in, you know, when they're failing on that. But it really does start with the water system.
Walt, what would you recommend consumers do if they're on? We've talked about private well systems and testing that water. What about folks who are getting water from public systems?
Well, most of the time, 99% of the time, that water is going to be perfectly safe. But there are some concerns, as May has indicated, especially if you're on a surface water system. They tend to have a lot more kind of organic contaminants than a groundwater system. And, of course, there's also issues about inside your home. I think lead was mentioned earlier. The lead usually is not in the water coming into your home. It's actually leaching the lead out of your pipes if you have an older home. So if you have an older home, you might consider, and you're concerned about lead, you might consider contacting the water department, because they're supposed to be in charge of making sure that the water is not corrosive and not releasing lead into the system.
May, when it comes to big picture solutions in the NRDC, are there any that the NRDC supports that wouldn't just improve, as we're talking about, the monitoring system as well as the notification process to make sure that people trust that the water that they're drinking is safe?
Sorry, are there
any big picture solutions that the NRDC supports to help improve this situation?
Well, in general, I think the biggest issue is that, you know, infrastructure is kind of out of sight, out of mind. So until your water main breaks and you can't drink the water, people don't really pay that much attention to it. And like I said, ours is deteriorating around the country. There are water systems that are, you know, 100 years old or more. And so funding to upgrade that infrastructure would go a long way towards improving the quality of our drinking water. And so that's something that is really important for all residents, really, to advocate for their cities and states to get more funding to help them upgrade their infrastructure. But there's also a lot of things that we think could be done to improve regulations, to improve, say, the lead and copper rules, so that, you know, the Flints don't happen. And a lot of that has to do with more transparency and notification, as well as better monitoring and testing of the water. So, and enforcement, obviously.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot that you all would advocate that needs to be done.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank May Wu for being with us with the NRDC's health program, and Walt Kelly with the Illinois State Water Survey Center for Groundwater Science. We will have that information if you want to test your water up at our website. Walt, May, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Of all the ways you could talk about poetry, do puppets come to mind? What about movement and music? Well, this is how the iconic poet Gwendolyn Brooks is being brought to life in an inventive stage project that's going to be presented Thursday night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. It's called No Blue Memories, The Life of Gwendolyn Brooks.
Thank you. I guess I'd better offer you We Real Cool. Most young people know me only by that one. I don't mean that I dislike it, but I would prefer it if the textbook compilers and the anthologists would assume that I've written a few other poems.
The play was written and conceived of by Eve Ewing and Nate Marshall for the Poetry Foundation and brought to life by the Chicago-based performance collective Manual Cinema. Again, as I mentioned, there's a public performance tonight at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana at 7:30. But two of Manual Cinema's members are with me now in our Urbana studio, puppeteer Laquise Harkins and music director and composer Ayanna Woods. Ayanna, Laquise, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I wonder if I could start by asking what your first experience was or encounters was with Gwendolyn Brooks' poetry.
I think I'm late to the game in terms of learning about Gwendolyn Brooks. She has such a huge presence in Chicago. And both of, well, a lot of people in my family are really involved in the Chicago poetry community. The co-composer, my sister Jamila Woods, is a teaching artist at Young Chicago Authors. And so in the process of preparing myself to work on this production, I definitely leaned a lot on Jamila's expertise poetry-wise and learned a lot that I wish I'd learned a lot earlier, because she's such an inspiring figure.
Right. And I wonder what you find most Ayanna, what you find most inspiring about. There's so much in her life. Mm-hmm. But there's so many firsts when you talk about Gwendolyn Brooks in terms of the things that she accomplished. But I wonder what you find most inspiring.
I was really inspired by the fact that there was no line between her art and her relationship to her community. Mm-hmm. Because for me, having grown up, or not grown up necessarily, but in recent years, I've been in really academic settings doing my art, where that's not always emphasized. And so to see that throughout her life, she was responding to all of these letters from people from people who were inspired by her, and coming back again and again to Jenner Elementary to be a graduation speaker at an 8th grade graduation, even after she won a Pulitzer Prize, is amazing to me.
Luquise, what about you?
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm born and raised in Chicago, but I kind of took her for granted. I did know the poem "We Real Cool," so they didn't go too far in school in terms of telling us who she was and what her impact was or anything like that. So when I started doing the research, I said, this woman was amazing. And when I started to talk to people about me doing the production, so many people had personal stories. Oh, from we had the same dry cleaner to so-and-so gave her a ride to this place or that place. So that ordinary, everyday woman who would just observe and write poetry or actually be a part of the community, like you said, fascinates me. It does. And so there's a line in the play where one of the students says that she was moved by her presence. And I think that more than anything, that's what I've taken away from it. She's not the loud person in the room, the life of the party. I'm not saying that she wasn't. You know, she even talks about the parties that they had and they went to. But it wasn't about that. She had a quiet demeanor, a spirituality to her, and I'm enthralled.
What would you tell people about her if they aren't familiar with her works? How would you describe her?
That's a very good question. I had the image one time when I was reading something, and it just reminded me of an ember, right? Like, if you see an ember, that's still fire. So you can't judge it by the cover. Like, you can't judge her by her voice. You can't judge her by where she's from. You can't judge her by her circumstances. The work stands on its own. You can read these words, but you don't know the work that went into it, that crafted it. She's a genius. She's a genius with our language. And her ability to relate to people and pull their greatness out of them is so inspiring to me.
Ayanna, I wonder then, thinking about this poetry of this woman, how would you describe what No Blue Memories is? Because this is a pretty unique production also. It's a theatrical production that includes a lot of things that you maybe wouldn't think of with theater.
Yeah. I think I still kind of have trouble describing to people what the production is to people in a way that they can really visualize it. It's really something you have to be in the room to, I'm plugging right now. Something you have to be in the room to really experience.
It's definitely, you're going to see a live short film that incorporates live action, puppetry, live music. It took me a long time to be able to say that.
Yeah.
we would just talk on and on and on and say what it is. And it's like, but you still have to see it. You do.
Mm-hmm.
What's the goal with bringing this to audiences outside of Chicago? So this performance is in Urbana. You have been doing performances for 2 days for school children throughout Central Illinois who are coming. And then there's this public performance this evening. Mm-hmm. What's your hope with that?
I think it's really special to be able to do performances for young students. And we've done student performances and public performances before in Chicago. With the older audiences, it's a very different energy because a lot of them have lived through the events that we're depicting in the story. With the younger audiences, they will have a lot of questions about, you know, the Chicago Picasso or what were the riots. And just contextualizing her poetry in the history, I think, is really a special thing to be able to do for students.
And also, when we first did it, we were celebrating her centennial. So she is still someone that we're celebrating in doing this play. And for a lot of people, we're introducing them to her, even now. So I think that's a big part of taking the show on the road, too.
That's Laquise Harkins. She's a puppeteer in the show that we're talking about. Ayanna Woods is also with us, the music director and composer, both of them Chicago-based and members of the performance collective Manual Cinema. I wonder if we could play a little bit of the music. So yes. Let's hear a little bit of it first, actually.
We're real cool. We left school. We learned late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We sing sin. Chin. We binge jazz June. We jazz June. We die soon.
I love that music because it really gives you a sense of the energy of the production. Mm-hmm. Ayanna, how did you think about composing all of that and putting, when you think about Gwendolyn Brooks' words, putting music around it, what was that process like for you?
Mm-hmm. We were thinking about a few things. At that point in the play, we're about halfway through. And so Jamila and I were thinking about kind of contemporaneously kind of the style of music to choose. So we wanted to do, especially for We Real Cool, her most well-known poem, which I'm not sure if she had mixed feelings about that being her most well-known poem, but it is the first window through which people can sort of connect with her poetry because it's so popular. We wanted that to be sort of a big climax in the middle. So we did that funk song, and it comes after Laquise speaks the poem. So we kind of have these iterations of, the spoken poem, and the music escalating and kind of spinning out into this, like, party.
Laquise, can I ask you, can I put you on the spot and ask you to do a little bit of the poem now?
Sure. Yes, I can. So when you see the production, we actually play out certain parts of her life. And she said that she really was walking through her neighborhood, as she would do, and saw some young guys playing pool. She had questions about it, and then we had the poem. So it's the pool players, 7 at the Golden Shovel. We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We die soon.
Wow, thank you. Thanks for sharing that, because there's so much in there that we could spend a really long time unpacking just that.
Yes.
I wonder when you present that to, especially I'm thinking about school kids, what's their reaction to hearing that?
Well, today, one of the shows that we did before, students just, they were elementary school students, jumped in. They were clapping and they were moving and grooving. And I think that's where it met them, right? And it's just really interesting to know that when she first did the poem, people thought it was controversial. Jazz June, is this sexual innuendo? What is it? So everyone responds differently, and it's always great to hear questions about the process from young students. Mm-hmm. So they're definitely in it with us. It's not over their head, and that's another great thing about her writing, too. She's with you, and she expects your intelligence and respects your intelligence, too.
So you are not just acting, you are also a puppeteer. Part of this is using overhead projectors. As you said, it's sort of how this live film plays out. Have you ever done anything like this before?
Absolutely not.
Okay. So how did that come about, and how did you learn how to inhabit those roles?
Right. So Manual Cinema, Sarah Fornace, Drew Durr, they were very patient with us. I'm right-handed. My left hand has to work also. And my left hand is like, what are you doing?
You're doing both hands.
You're doing both hands. Okay. And then when you're looking at the screen, like when the projector is projecting the image, it's backwards from what the actual audience will see. And sometimes
you're... So is it like a mirror? It's like a mirror image, or it's upside down?
Upside down and backwards. So if you look... Okay. If you look at the projector, it's upside down and backwards. There's a screen in front of us where it's backwards, but it's right side up. And then the audience is seeing it. Seeing the movie.
Because you're behind everything, so you're behind the screen.
We're behind the screen that
but
the
also
audience
visible.
Can see.
Part of the cool part is that you can see the process as it's happening, and the actors changing wigs and taking something on, putting something off, switching projectors. die rolling underneath the screen so that they don't interrupt the shot. You know,
yes.
We were talking yesterday about how it's a really interesting intersection of athletic and delicate,
mm-hmm.
because you're moving these really tiny paper puppets, doing the dialogue with them, and then also, you know, LaQuisha is wearing knee pads.
Yes, you have to. You have to be ready. You have to roll. You have to jump. And if it's your first time seeing it, if anything feels a little overwhelming, you can always just look at the screen. The mm-hmm. movie is there. But of course, you want to watch everything because there's the band and the projectors and everything else. So it's definitely a rich experience.
So, Ayanna, I wonder when you were thinking about the music, what was the goal with it? Because it was something to not just fit the poetry, but lend itself to puppetry, advance mm-hmm. this whole story, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing about working with Manual Cinema on this is that a lot of the elements came together sort of at the same time. So sometimes we were writing music for a scene that had we hadn't seen the animation for it yet, and we didn't know how long things were going to be, but we knew what the script was, what the moment required, you know, and what the goal idea was to come across. So as we were stitching things together, it was a lot of back and forth with the animators and even with the playwrights as well. Some things got shortened, some things got lengthened to sort of give it a more filmic timing.
I want to ask both of you what you think is missing from what's taught about Gwendolyn Brooks for people who do know about her, and what you hope that what that comes through maybe perhaps in the performance in a way that people who maybe just read about her or read her poetry and have just read her poetry and not known very much about her life, if they what they've missed out on?
It's a really good question. I see her as many writers are, a great observer of society and of culture. But she has poems for children. She has fun poems, entertaining poems, political poems, poems that talk about the signs of the times. And I want people to know that. She was a Pulitzer Prize winner. So it wasn't all about sonnets, but she could do that too. So there's every type of poem you can think of. She was a master at it. She was a master at it.
Mm-hmm. And every type of subject, too. I think people sometimes don't expect to find really high art coming from a really everyday subject about, like, sitting in your front porch or about walking down the street and seeing pool players. Like, your own everyday life could be the source of art and is a valid source mm-hmm. of art. Yes. I think that's really important. Yeah.
And I wonder, when you think about what her relevance is today in America 2018, what stands out for you?
Having your voice, knowing that you can make a difference and it is in you, start with you. There's a question that she poses to her students, and we use it in the play. Who are you and how do you feel about yourself? Start there. Because all of your decisions are going to come from there. We don't necessarily think about that all the mm-hmm. time. But it is so important. Check in with yourself. Check in with your community. How are you going to make a change if you don't know who you are and how you feel about who you are?
Thanks for that, LaQuisha. Ayanna, do you want to add anything else?
She said it.
That is, thanks so much. That's LaQuisha Harkins, who's a puppeteer in the show. Ayanna Woods has also been with us, the music director and composer. And let's say goodbye by hearing some more of your music. But ladies, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
Then Jim, wait, just Jim, wait, just the...
Try.
listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Art has been a part of our HIV world, our AIDS world, since the very beginning. In the early days, when we didn't have anything but our anger, we didn't have medication, we didn't have an HIV test, we had art.
That's a clip from the film Alternative Endings, Activist Risings. It's part of the Day Without Art, a project organized by the New York-based nonprofit Visual AIDS, which seeks to fight and recognize AIDS through art. And as part of a Day Without Art and World Day, AIDS Day on December 1st, there's going to be some screenings of the film. It's actually six short films all back-to-back in one. And that's starting tomorrow at the Krannert Art Museum in Urbana. There will be other screenings of the film later in the month in Chicago. We'll tweet out all the information and have it up at our website at 21stshow.org. Right now, though, to tell us more about this is director and Illinois native Anand Kalra. He's on the line from Oakland, California. Also joining us is Barb Cardell. Barb is the chair of the board of directors for the Positive Women's Network. That's a nationwide advocacy group of women living with HIV, and they're featured in Anand's film. She's on the line from Boulder, Colorado. Barb, Anand, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much, Nyla. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Barb, can I just start by asking, this year marks the 29th Day Without Art. How did this begin almost 30 years ago?
Yeah, you know, it's an amazing response from the artistic community as we look back in the early days of HIV. So many people who were sick and dying were in New York City, San Francisco, L.A., and they were artists, they were dancers, they were curators of museums, and they wanted a response that could talk about World AIDS Day, but also could talk about the impact it had on the art world. So they really went ahead and suggested that there be a day where museums were closed and art was shrouded, especially if it had been created by an artist living with HIV, that some information be put up instead, and that that be used as a ongoing effort to educate the population around HIV, how it is transmitted, and how people living with HIV go about their everyday life.
How do you think that message has changed now? Because certainly 3 decades ago, it was a very different message. It was a very different time when we were looking, when we were thinking about the AIDS crisis, and when we look at the medications and other drugs that are available now for folks. What do you want the message to be now through art?
Yeah, the message now is that people are still living with HIV, that we're still very much a part of the United States and society, but that stigma and discrimination tends to drive people further underground, that they're not comfortable sharing their status, that they are afraid that they're going to lose their job. And so I think the message is two-pronged, which is that HIV is a disease that has so much scientific understanding. We know that if somebody is on effective medication, that they're not able to transmit their virus. That's powerful, powerful news. But on the other hand, that if we don't start talking about how we bring people living with HIV into society, into our lives, whether it's through art or whether it's just through jobs or access to healthcare, that HIV will continue to kill people and we will continue to lose people. So it feels like the Day Without Art is important to acknowledge that it is still killing people and people are still, we're still losing people in our community.
Anand, when we think about the short film that you did, I wonder if I can ask you a little bit about what went into putting that together, because it's an interesting film because a lot of it is about art and the role that art plays in the community for the Positive Women's Network. Was that what you were trying to get across?
Yeah, I was so pleased to be called in to make the film, and actually Barb did some of the filming that you'll see in there as well. You know, the goal with the film really was to be able to show people as being whole and to be in their strengths and to really kind of tease out the ways that for an organization like Positive Women's Network, which its whole focus is on relationship building and building organizing power, to show that it's not just, you know, waving signs in the street. You know, that's not all that protest is. That's not all that advocacy is. And it was so beautiful to be able to talk with some of the members and to hear the story from the Colorado chapter about the way that they intentionally use art and art making to build community so that there is this kind of protected safe space separate from being on that kind of front lines of the battle feeling.
How many chapters do you all have, Anant?
PWN, I believe, has currently 5 chapters nationwide, and then there's also different programs with state leads, and then we have a general membership of closing in on 500. I could be wrong about that number.
Barb, I wonder why you think it's important. It seems, I wonder why, if you could just underscore for us, it's important to find or form community, particularly for women who are living with HIV.
Oh, you know, living with HIV, I've been living with HIV since 1991. And what I know for myself and for other women living with HIV is that we feel invisible. We feel like we don't have a right to participate. And so being involved in art and art projects and coming together in community means that we can find our voice. We also can find our joy and our passion, spend time together and feel visible once again. That's why the Visual AIDS Project with the video is so powerful, because it shares that, you know, not only are we activists, but we also really just enjoy being in community and having people to spend time with that we can share really who we are at our most valuable, but most importantly, that we're not invisible any longer.
And Barb, as you can really, this comes out in the film, and I'm thinking in particular, you, We Hate played a little bit of you talking about this at the beginning, about how in the beginning, when we didn't have anything but our anger and we didn't have medication, we had art. So not just does it express that outrage, but as you said, it also expresses joy. And in the film, instead of being a traditional support group where I guess women are kind of sitting around talking to each other, the women are creating art with each other. So you guys are painting masks, you're silk screening T-shirts. Why is that an important way to instead of, it's such a different way of thinking about a support group.
Yeah, and I actually, you know, say that we're more of a group where you come and get support rather than a traditional support group. We, you know, come and we find that as we connect doing our art, whether it's masks or making jewelry or silk screening, that we come together. We use it often as a fundraiser to get us to conferences or other places where we can center the voices of women living with HIV. So it has an economic justice lens to it as well. But by connecting in a deeper way, we now are showing up in each other's lives in just a broad and diverse way. So we go to each other's weddings, or we babysit each other's kids, or we cook dinner together. And that has been built on this trust and this connection that we have. And that, again, means that people are not isolated and they're not alone. And that is the most profound support, because it's not just 1 hour a week. It's a deeper heart connection with, you know, and for PWN, we say we're a sisterhood. And it really does feel like we connect through our art, through our lives, into sisterhood.
That's Barb Cardell. We've been talking to Barb and Anand Kalra with the Positive Women's Network about this short film they're featured in. It's part of this Day Without Art screening that's going to start tomorrow at the Cranern Art Museum. And I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation, someone who's going to be part of the local conversations in Urbana. Mike Benner is with me in our studios right now in Urbana. He's the executive director of the Greater Community AIDS Project that services 10 counties across East and Central Illinois. He's going to be participating in all of this stuff as well, as I mentioned. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me today.
Mike, as we're talking about this idea of how the conversation around AIDS and HIV has changed in the past 3 decades, I wonder if you can tell us about just what it looks like when we're thinking. Barb has brought up the whole idea of marginalization, and I wanted to ask you about a further marginalized community. If we think about people of color who are living with HIV, here in Illinois, there's about 40,000 people living with an HIV infection, and of that, roughly 48% are African American. Is that correct?
That's about right, yes.
And that's according to the CDC. I wonder how you think HIV disproportionately affects communities of color.
Oh, that's kind of a tough question. But I mean, I think a lot of it is just the lack of knowledge. The younger African-American males just feel like they're invincible. And just lack of education about what's going on. They feel very hesitant to go get tested, which is a big barrier into getting health care.
And do you, would you say that's in general a problem among most of the community when we're thinking about awareness about HIV right now? Is just that, is it really a question of people not being aware and not thinking about it or not talking about it?
I think a lot of it is people just don't want to talk about it. That it's kind of, since it went from a terminal illness to more of a chronic illness, people don't see it as a threat anymore. So they just kind of become very complacent. That's why I think things like this that we have this weekend here in town are very important to kind of bring that message back that, yes, it is still out there. It hasn't gone away. We still have people getting infected every day. We have people dying every day.
What do you think are other important messages to get out there? What do you want people to understand about HIV or AIDS that they might not?
Well, I think the primary one is that it is a chronic illness anymore. That, I mean, it is able to be treated. I mean, we have PrEP now, so people that can take the medication on a daily basis to prevent being infected. As one of the other panelists said, that, I mean, we have U equals U, undetectable equals untransmissible. I mean, that's a big step. I mean, that, I mean, it kind of combines both prevention and care together. That, I mean, that by people being in care that are already HIV positive, they're basically preventing it from infecting somebody else.
Barb, when you think about this, as you have mentioned, you have been HIV positive since 1991. You said that one thing that kind of struck me, you said that you feel in some ways invisible. Do you feel like the projects like this help raise the visibility, help people understand a little bit more about this community?
Absolutely. Often there have been movies that have been describing the lives of people living with HIV from an external point of view. And while it's powerful, they also can be, tokenizing or diminishing. And so I love this video because and this project because it comes from our perspective and talks about what it's like to be us a little bit, which is not terribly different than anybody else. And I think that is a stigma-busting metaphor right there around HIV, which is so important.
Mm-hmm. Anand, what are you hoping people take away from the film, from not just your short, but the other five others that are there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's so much in them. I haven't had a chance to see. They've been kind of under wrapped, so I haven't seen the other ones besides the ones that we've made yet. But I know that they come from a wide variety of communities and diverse organizations. So I'm hoping that people are able to take away from it a couple of things. One, that people living with HIV are just that. They're living with HIV and shifting that public image of this kind of very stigmatized sick person in the hospital. And remember, like, these are people. These are our community members who are living full lives and have interests and skills beyond an illness. So that's one part of it. And then also just being able to, remember what the contribution of people living with HIV is and has been to arts. So kind of the both and there.
There's a lot going on for folks in Central Illinois. So as I mentioned, this film is going to be looping at the Cranon Art Museum November 30th and December 1st. December 1st, that's Saturday, there's going to be a screening in Champaign at the Art Theater. December 15th in Chicago, this will be screening at the Museum of Contemporary Art. I want to thank Mike Benner for being with us with the executive director. He's the executive director of the Greater Community AIDS Project. And Anand Kalra and Barb Cardell from the Positive Women's Network. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That does it for us this week. Coming up on Monday's show, we're going to be celebrating Illinois' 200th birthday. Join us as we look back on some of our favorite conversations we've had about Illinois' bicentennial. All year we've been talking about this, including Illinois history and the best Illinois movies. So tune in Monday for that. As I mentioned, our website, 21stshow.org, I've mentioned a couple times during the hour, it's a good resource for ways to contact us, suggest story ideas to us, send us emails. We'd love to hear your feedback and find all of our social media handles. So if you want to follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, or look for past shows, all you have to remember is 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here on Monday.